Welcome to Heartline. I'm Rita Schulte, a licensed therapist in the Northern Virginia, D.C. area, and I'm passionate about matters of the heart. I want to check the pulse on your heart by taking a look at some of the cutting-edge issues that are affecting you and the people around you, and have you consider, how in the world is all this mess called life affecting your heart? To help stir things up, we're going to be talking to some of the leading professionals in the Christian counseling and literary industry, as well as hosting discussions with real people who are struggling with real life issues. If you want to know a little bit about me, check me out at siftedaswheat.com, where you can ask questions, find out about my book, listen to other podcasts, or request to be a guest on the show. You can also find me on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC, or follow me on Twitter at Heartline Pod. So let's get going on this journey of the heart. As the daughter of Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Anne Sexton, Linda Sexton witnessed her mother's enigmatic presence, but also her multiple and ultimately successful suicide attempts, which led her to struggle with an engulfing undertow of depression. In Linda's book, Half in Love, she conveys with powerful and unsparing prose her urgent need to escape the legacy of suicide that consumed her family, a topic rarely explored, even today in such poignant depth. People magazine called Linda's book a courageous journey into the dark terrain of remembering, forgiving, and healing through telling, a trait that is her birthright. Linda Grace Sexton tries multiple times to kill herself. Even though as a daughter, sister, wife, and most importantly a mother, she knows the pain her act would cause. But unlike her mother's story, Linda's is ultimately one of triumph. Through the help of family, therapy, and medicine, she confronts deep-seated issues and curbs the haunting cycle of suicide she once seemed destined to inherit. A graduate of Harvard University, Linda has published several widely acclaimed novels, as well as two memoirs about her life and relationship with her mother. Searching for Mercy Street, My Journey Back to My Mother, was named a New York Times Book Review Notable Book and received overwhelming critical acclaim. For more information, visit her at www.lindagraysexton.com. Linda, welcome to Heartline.
Thanks so much for having me, Rita. It's a pleasure.
You grew up with a famous mother, but one who was extremely troubled. Can you start us out by helping us understand what that was like for you as a child?
Well, fame is one thing, but mental illness is another. And as a child, I didn't experience the fame until later, until probably I was a teenager. But when I was younger, from two on, when I really began to experience the full effect of her suicide attempts, it was very difficult, you know. I was lonely. I was afraid. I didn't know if my mother was going to die. Was she going to die? What it was like for her to be in the hospital? Where would I go? All those kinds of questions and experiences revolved throughout my life and made it. It made it hard. It was very, very difficult to grow up in that house.
Mm. Now, were you and your sister close at that point? Could you kind of rely on her?
Yeah, my sister and I, you know, once we got to be... Well, my sister was away for a long time when my mother first got sick. And so we didn't really know each other for early years. But then when she came home, I was probably... three by then, four maybe. When she came home, we did get very close because the situation was so dire in the house that you had to be close to somebody. You had to be able to bond with someone. And we did that right through our teenage years. So, yeah, we were really close. We were really close.
Now, was your mother...
Later when things got tough.
Right. Was your mother... dismissive of you when you were little, or was she just so zoned out she couldn't really take care of you?
Well, I think it was really both. Mm-hmm. She couldn't take care of me, so she was dismissive of me.
Mm-hmm.
She couldn't stand the way I hung on to her and clung to her. She really wanted to be free of me. I think part of that came from being really ill prepared to be a mother in her late 20s and to try and do all the things that mothering requires when she was so ill. So it was kind of both things put together.
Mm-hmm. So how did that affect you on an attachment level? Do you think, you mentioned, you know, you clung to her. Do you think that made you more dependent and clingy or more avoidant?
No, clingier, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
She talks in her diaries and her journals about how she couldn't stand the way I clung to her and the way I was dependent and couldn't stand up for myself on my own two feet. And, of course, I was too little.
Mm-hmm.
She wanted me to be older than I was. And when I did get older, then she was a much better mom because she didn't have to take care of me anymore.
Right. Reading your story, it was apparent that you really took care of her on so many levels. Did you feel responsible for her happiness, do you think?
Yeah, I did. It was hard, you know. She was so incapacitated, and I was cast into the role of caretaker from a really early age. I mean, when I was 8, I was mixing her martinis. By the time I got to be 12 and was more adult, she saw me as an adult when I was 12, even though I don't think 12-year-olds are adults.
No, not at all.
You know, I was reading her poetry and commenting on it and had been cast into an adult role where I took care of her, you know, when she came home from the hospital, things like that.
And so, do you think you assigned yourself that role? Why not your sister?
I think that it was probably mother assigning me the role and me playing the role easily because I felt that it kept her safe.
Mm.
If I took care of her, she wouldn't go back to the hospital. Mm-hmm. If I was a really good little girl, I wouldn't be sent away. She wouldn't go back to the hospital, and I wouldn't be sent away because I was sent away at a very early age to be taken care of by other people for a short while.
Yeah, absolutely. So you became the pleaser, the try-harder, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And where did they send you?
They sent me to my mother's middle sister, my aunt, who wasn't at all prepared to take on another child. She had five of her own, and an abusive husband who was an alcoholic.
Oh, my gosh.
And, you know, another small child was the last thing she needed. So I didn't really get good parenting there either from either one of them.
So you must have been fearful.
In later life, I thought that I had been there for 2 years, and it turned out I'd only been there a matter of months.
Really?
Yeah.
Were you fearful there?
Oh, yeah. I was afraid. I had terrible anxiety there. That's where I remember my first anxiety attack.
Really?
Yeah.
And so what did you do with all that, Linda, as a little girl? Did you hold it in and stuff it?
That's hard to know. I mean, I think that I held it in and stuffed it. I certainly did that by the time I was starting to get a little older,
mm-hmm.
when I was 8 or 9, because, you know, I wanted to keep her safe. And if I were crying and falling apart all over the place, I wouldn't be keeping her safe.
Right. Where was your dad in all this in the early years?
Well, in the early years, well, he traveled a great deal. So that was one problem. And he really tried to take care of her, but it was, you know, it was a tall order. She had a lot of psychiatrists who were telling us what to do and, you know, just basically pushing us around. And he didn't understand it from that point of view. He didn't, you know, it was very overwhelming
mm-hmm.
for him.
And how did he relate to you guys?
I think we looked up to him as a comfort and someone who tried to take care of us and tried to be there for us and who was just overwhelmed. I think I understood how overwhelmed he was because I was overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
And he was gone a lot because he was traveling to try and make a living and to try and take care of us all and to pay for all the psychiatric bills and everything else that was there.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting, you know, beliefs drive our behavior. And so you mentioned a little earlier that you had a belief that if I keep her safe, then I'll be safe. She won't go to the hospital. She won't kill herself, whatever. And that kind of became your theme for your entire life until she died.
That's right. It did become a theme. It's a theme that, you know, played in and out for the whole time she was alive.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel when she tried to commit suicide? Do you remember?
Well, when she tried to commit suicide and I was young, I was very frightened and felt alone and just overwhelmed and scared. It was really hard when she tried, and she tried so many times. people have asked me, how many times did she try? And, I don't know exactly how many times she tried, but enough so that it was, you know, a constant threat in the household.
And would you say anything to her? Would you plead with her at times?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think both Joy and I would try to make nice and try to keep her happy so that this wasn't an issue, so she wouldn't be depressed even when she was. I think both of us did that. Joy was a little bit of a naughty girl. I think she took things out, you know, by trying to get attention and divert things from my mother by, you know, acting out. And I took the other role. But both of us were desperate not to have her be sick.
Right. Did you ever blame yourself?
I think you blame yourself continually when you have someone who's mentally ill and who's trying to commit suicide frequently. You know, you don't know who else to blame. If you blame the person, then they're just going to be more likely to try again, and you're very conscious of trying to keep the status quo. So, yeah, you blame yourself, and, you know, you wonder what you can do to change your own behavior to keep it from happening again.
Mm-hmm. So what were some of your, well, if I'd only done this?
Oh, it depended on the situation. You know, if I'd only done better in school, if only I'd consoled her here, there, and everywhere, if only I'd been more stable, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of an endless list.
Were you present, and did you ever find her in one of these attempts?
You know, I honestly don't know. Certainly not when I was older, but when I was younger, it's possible. I just don't have any, you know,
recollection.
Strong memories.
What was it like when she finally succeeded?
Well, that was a whole different story, because by then we were so overwhelmed by the continual threat that I think we were glad to have her, not glad, that's not the right word, but
relieved,
to have her finally do this thing that she'd been threatening us with for so long. You know, we were, at the same time that we were angry and at the same time we were devastated, we were relieved because it was the end of the horror show.
Did you ever get a real reason why she was so sad, or do you think it was just all this chemical mess going on for her? Because I think so many times people just say, well, snap out of it, get over it, get up and get moving.
Well, you do get that reaction a lot, and she certainly got it a lot from the family, from her parents, from her in-laws, probably some from my father, who didn't understand what was going on. And I do think a lot of it was chemical, and she never got treated for that. There were never adequate, you know, and precise medications. There weren't the sorts of things we have now, which really help us. She didn't have the advantage of any of that. So, yeah, she got a lot of straighten up and fly right. That's what it was called in my family, straighten up and fly right. And I myself got that later on when I became ill. So I knew firsthand what it was like for her to be told that.
Sure.
It's pretty devastating.
What did they diagnose her with, Linda, back then?
They diagnosed her with hysteria, which is an old diagnosis that
it goes back to Freud.
Came about like in Freud's time.
Yes.
And they didn't really ever get a good diagnosis on her. They never got bipolar, and that's clearly what she was.
So there was anger for you, relief in some way. And then you found yourself engulfed by the same demons that destroyed her. Can you talk about the fears and beliefs that accompanied that when you first started experiencing some of those feelings?
Well, first, you know, I worried continually that the same thing was going to happen to me. And I just didn't know how to handle the similarities between my life and hers. And I was depressed from a very early age and tried to, at one point when I was a teen, sort of made a half-hearted suicide attempt. But basically, as I got older, I began to worry more and more, for instance, when I had children. And, you know, I wanted to be a good mom. I didn't want to be a dependent mom. I didn't want to be a sick mom. And, you know, those things began to come into my life as my depression deepened. And then I just became overwhelmingly depressed and began to fear that I was going to turn out to be just like her.
Right.
And I actually had a host on a show that I did an interview on say to me, what are you planning for your 45th birthday? Because that was the year in her life that she killed herself.
Mm.
I was sort of stunned by the question. I didn't have any plans for my 45th birthday.
Wow.
But he said, I think you should give a party on your mother's grave.
Oh, my gosh, are you kidding me?
It was a terrible, terrible thing to have said. When I got to be 45, of course, there were terrible resonances for me because that was the year she died in her lifetime, and that was the year that I got really, really sick.
Yeah. So when did you actually begin to realize that something was wrong with you? Like, as early as your teenage years, or was
it
after? Okay.
Really as early as my teenage years, because I was dealing so much with depression and terrible anxiety. And I started seeing a psychiatrist in those years, and that was helpful to me.
And what did they do? Did they give you medication?
No, no medication.
So how did you deal with the anxiety? What kinds of coping skills did you use?
I just went to my therapist every week and pulled my way through it. It was horrible.
Yeah.
You know, now we have medication for anxiety. I would still have anxiety if I didn't have my medication, but with my medication, I don't live with anxiety anymore.
Yes. And then you go through the whole, and I think folks generally go through this whole thing, oh, something's wrong with me, I'm not okay, I've got this issue, I've got this anxiety, so that makes me inadequate. And those are such lies. I mean, so much of this now, as we're learning over the last decade about the brain and how the brain's wired and the limbic area and all these things, and through the PET scans and SPECT scans, we can really help people see that this is really a clinical situation, and people, especially families, can gain a better understanding of how to help a person who's suffering.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, we just have much more available to us than we had before. And because of that, I for one, don't suffer the way my mother suffered any longer, because I finally got my medication straightened out, and I'm able to function in a whole different way than she was able to function.
Right.
So I feel really, really grateful. I mean, a lot of people, when I go and I do talks for my book, people will say to me, well, how can you be on medication for so long? How can you? And I'm like, would you tell a diabetic not to take their medication?
Absolutely.
You know, so I'm really grateful that I have it.
Yeah. Did you believe your mother was as sick as she was, or did it take you having your own illness and bout with this to realize the degree of her impairment?
I think I knew she was really sick, but I think I also thought that she was very dramatic about it. I mean, she wrote about it, she used it to become well known with, and I don't think I really understood what the depths of it were like until my own illness began. And then I began to see there was only one way out, and that way seemed at the time to be suicide.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I only really understood it when I got to be older and began to experience like feelings.
Right. And that had to be scary for you, too.
Yeah. That was very, very difficult. It was very difficult.
So obviously you were enmeshed with your mother. Did you realize how enmeshed with your mother you were?
Well, I don't think I did in the beginning. I think I liked being enmeshed because there were all sorts of bonuses. You got to hang around with the adults. You got to do adult things. But as time went on, it became more and more difficult. And when I started seeing this therapist when I was 16, first thing she did was to try and separate me from my mother and allow me to do my own growing up and find myself. So that was good.
Right.
And that was a positive thing. But before that, I don't think I recognized it. And it was only with her help that I was able to conquer it.
Oh, that's awesome, though. Now, do you think you took that same codependent kind of pattern and had that going on in your marriage at all?
No.
Okay.
Because I learned so much from that therapy about what devastation it brings when you don't allow your children to grow up on their own. You don't allow your husband to think about anything except you. I'd seen firsthand the devastation that it caused. So I was very careful with my own kids.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just even when there were times where I wanted to depend on them the way I had been depended upon, I didn't let myself do that. Mm-hmm. It was really important to me.
Do you think you were overly dependent on your husband?
Oh, on my husband?
Yes.
I was probably more dependent on him than I should have been because, you know, I was sick and I needed mm-hmm. an adult to be able to back me up. And, of course, he wasn't there for me. So it didn't work very well in the end. You know, the marriage just fell apart because he couldn't deal with my illness.
Mm-hmm. But you were able to keep it together for quite a while. I mean, you were on the top of your game professionally. You were writing for soap operas, being interviewed by People magazine. How was all that? And when did things really start breaking down for you?
Well, all that professional success was terrific. It made me feel really good about myself. And I think I was able to kind of push my demons away by saying, you know, you're doing well. You've got two children. You've got a wonderful husband. He's very successful. You're successful in your own right. Things are going well for you. But the little voice started creeping up on me and kind of undermining me. And eventually, starting when I was in my early 40s and culminating when I was 45, you know, it just basically began to overwhelm me. And then finally it did.
Mm-hmm. So those were dark years for you.
Those were dark years.
Now, did shame keep you from telling how bad you really felt?
Oh, yeah. You know, you feel horribly ashamed. You don't want anyone to know, so you try to hide it and go underground with it, which, of course, makes it worse because then you get isolated.
Absolutely.
And isolation is one of the worst possible things for somebody who's depressed or bipolar. I just didn't want to have to explain to anyone why I felt the way I felt, so I hid it.
All right. And you hid it on some level from your husband.
I hid it a lot from my husband.
Yes.
I didn't want him to know, which is why he was so taken aback when I fell apart.
So why was that? I mean, with him, I mean, you trusted him, and what would cause you to want to hide it from him?
I guess I must have been scared on some level that he would leave.
Okay.
You know, my own father stayed through so much, but I knew my husband had trouble with people who were sick, and I think I just knew that he was going to not be able to deal with this.
Okay.
So I tried to shut it out, and I didn't want it to touch my kids either.
Yeah.
So I tried to shut it off that way.
Mm-hmm. So the belief that he'll leave is what caused you to emotionally withdraw.
Yeah.
What would you have done differently?
Well, I wouldn't have allowed myself to go so far down the chute, that's for sure. I would have gotten to a therapist sooner. At the time all this happened, I wasn't actually seeing anyone. And I should have been seeing someone and getting medication much sooner than I actually did. By the time I got medication, I was, you know, in a really bad way. I tried to kill myself, and I had to find a therapist at that point and haul myself backwards instead of saying, you know, I'm feeling really bad. I better do something about this right away.
Can you help people understand what that dark place is like for someone who would want to take their life? I mean, that you made two suicide attempts?
I made three.
Three, okay.
It's really hard for people to imagine how you could want to take your own life because people have such a strong life drive and don't understand why someone would want to embrace death. But the fact is, when you're in such pain, and it is not just mental pain, there's physical anguish that goes along with it. You have stomach aches, you have anxiety, your
headaches,
body
maybe.
Aches.
Yeah.
It's just like kind of like having the flu.
Mm-hmm.
And there's even an ad running on television right now for a medication. And they show someone who's kind of all hunched over on a bed who is experiencing physical symptoms. So not only do you have the mental anguish, but you have physical problems as well. And you begin to see or to think that the only way out of this, you're in a dark, dark tunnel. There's no way anyone can touch you. You're totally alone. and the only light you can see is the light of suicide, to get out of the pain. Mm-hmm. You would do anything to get out of the pain, and every day waking up brings more pain. So the only way you can imagine to lose the pain is to lose your life. Mm-hmm. And the only way to lose your life is to do it yourself.
Right. Now, the last attempt you made, that was almost the end. You made a call to your kids, was that right?
Yeah.
And that's eventually how they tracked you and found you.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. It's probably the thing I'm most ashamed of, you know, that I involved my children at all. And I basically called to say goodbye, and I wouldn't tell them where I was. And after a certain point, I wouldn't talk to them anymore. And I tried to hang up the phone in my car, and I missed. And I didn't get it hung up, and the police found me by the sirens. I was at the airport, and they turned their sirens on, and they could hear them at the airport. So they figured out where I was. But I did it because I wanted to say goodbye to my kids. But in retrospect, it was very selfish. I shouldn't have done it. On the other hand, if I hadn't done it, I wouldn't be here.
Right,
so,
yeah.
My kids always say it was a good thing you did it, Mom.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you've done an awesome job about coming to terms with your past and finally putting things to rest. And are you writing more these days now?
Yeah, I just finished another book. It's a happy book this time.
Great!
It's about a happier time in my life. And
awesome.
About my dogs, of all things, about my 38. I've had 38 Dalmatians in my life. And
really?
They've really changed. They have changed my life for the better in their ways. So I decided I was going to write about my relationship there. And it's been a really fun book to work on.
Oh, that's so great, Linda. Well, you're a talented writer. I just couldn't put the book down. It's a heavy subject, but such a necessary one. Well, I'll look forward to reading your next book when it comes out. And thanks again for being with us, Linda.
Thank you, Rita. I've really enjoyed it.
God bless you. Thanks for joining me today. If you have a question or comment, or you'd like to be a guest on Heartline, I'd love to hear from you. You can contact me at siftedaswheat.com, on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC, or Twitter at Heartline Pod. And remember, it's your heart. Keep it alive. Check the pulse.